When we started Queerio, we wanted to educate, enlighten and promote equality. And this week, we hope to do just that.
Our guest for this episode is Olivia Yates Brown, a qualified nurse and an openly trans woman who'll be talking to us about her experiences.
But what is the situation like in the UK for trans people at the moment? While it may be hard to hear, according to Stonewall, 2 in 5 trans people have had a hate crime committed against them in the last year, and 2 in 5 trans young people have attempted suicide. 1 in 8 trans people have been physically attacked by colleagues or customers at their place of work.
But these shocking stats only tell one element of the story. Being trans in the UK no way means you're going to have a bad life. Trans people around the UK have rich, rewarding lives, careers, families and relationships, just as any other group of people do. Liv is actually an old friend from college, and we bonded over our love for performing arts and our lack of love for having to get the bus every morning. So it's nice to see you again. It's really cool.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, it's a long time no see.
Really long time. I mean, I was thinking about it the other day because it would have been, what, college? So it's well over 6 years ago.
Oh, fuck. Is it that long? Jesus.
I've been in Lincolnshire for 5 years, so it must be longer than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, uni, undergrad for me was like 5 years ago, so yeah, it would make sense, like,
literally,
6 years ago.
Definitely.
Oh, I'm old. We're old.
How did you two meet? You met in college?
Yeah, we met at Barton Peveril, which is our college. We went back in our hometown.
And, back when I lived down south.
Yeah. And we got the bus pretty much every day.
We did.
Made friends that way.
I like to joke that we bonded over our love of performing arts, but we did not bond over our love of getting the bus every morning.
we shared a love of performing arts as well. But Holly, you were never in any of my classes.
No, I think that's because you actually took drama, didn't you? Whereas I didn't, whereas I sort of wished I had, but I don't think I knew what I wanted to choose at college. I think I just chose whatever I felt like I had to choose. And then looking back, should have probably chosen different things, but live and learn.
Yeah, of course. So I am a trans woman, and I've been out for about 3 and a bit years now. So for me, like, it wasn't an identity that I sort of knew from the get-go. For me, it was much more about sort of learning and discovering sort of who I was as a person, you know, as we all do throughout our lives. And when I was younger, where I grew up, we didn't necessarily really have much visibility of LGBT community. So there wasn't really the narrative regarding trans people. And if there was any at all, it was very biased, discriminatory, and generally seen in like a negative light. So really, for me, there was a period where I sort of, for my whole life, I sort of growing up, I'd always felt like different, like something was wrong, I guess. And it took me a while to sort of put all the pieces together, because the lack of narrative and sort of lack of visibility meant that sort of I kind of had to sort of figure things out on my own, and sort of piece the puzzle together, if you will. And it wasn't until sort of I started seeing more positive visibility sort of moved away from home that I kind of came to understand my identity as transgender, and was like, oh, that's what it is. That's who I am. It works. It makes sense. And it's been a bit of a journey. And it still is. It's still every day is a new day. And every day I learn something new. And it's really, it's been a long road. And it is still carrying on. But I think, like, where I am now is in a really good place. So I'm very
glad to hear that. Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that. I mean, I think you're so right. So obviously back at college, me and my friend at the time ran a society, which at the time was, and I can't stand this now, it was called the Gay Straight Alliance. And we took that over and changed it to what we called US, which was US standing understanding sexuality. And looking back, although that was kind of a cute name at the time, I think you're so right. Like, even in that society, there was nobody that kind of was outwardly trans or kind of said, you know, I'm glad it's kind of not what the rest of you are identifying as. So I can completely understand how, looking back, even though we felt we had this really inclusive place, even back then, it wasn't kind of as open as maybe we would hope that societies at colleges like that would be now.
And I also think that there wasn't necessarily in our, where we grew up, there wasn't necessarily the diversity for even, you know, for wanting to create that space. There wasn't even you can't, it's like building a foundation on sand. Like, you can't, you know, you're wanting to create this sort of diverse LGBT group when actually there wasn't, where we were, there wasn't really that much diversity.
No, definitely not.
In the people and the get-go. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like what it is here. I grew up in Lincoln, and then there wasn't much diversity at all. There's more now, but compared to when I was younger, there is. But yeah, then I moved to London for university, and it was just a whole different world instantly, and it was ridiculous. And then coming back to Lincoln's definitely a culture shock again.
I mean, that's what we say, Liv. The reason we started this podcast is Lincoln is very much like kind of Winchester was. It's like the extent of the LGBTQ support here is like a Facebook group and a gay bar that's obviously been shut for the last year anyway. So it's very similar. I mean, I think that might be more than Winchester even has.
You've got a gay bar.
I was just thinking that.
That's definitely one up.
Not that we didn't, you know, not that Winchester isn't a lovely place, but you're 100% right. You know, growing up in the South in that particular area, that, you know, the closest gay bar would have been Southampton, which is 40 minutes away. And again, it's for anyone under the age of 18, is kind of inaccessible.
Yeah, and I'm not by, like, when I talk about Winchester and when I talk about, you know, the, you know, sort of the lack of diversity, it is not in any way me poo-pooing my hometown or saying bad things about it. It is a matter of fact. It is what it is. The population is the population. And it just, so Winchester and sort of, I'd definitely say Hampshire as a whole is quite, has a very similar population diversity.
Yeah, no, that's very well put. Yeah, definitely. I can completely agree.
Obviously, Holly's let me know a little bit about you beforehand, and I want to know, like, what inspired you to go into nursing? Like, what made you want to go into that field?
So, it was kind of, going into nursing was kind of, it was very unexpected for me, but it kind of, I kind of fell into nursing, if that makes sense. I did my undergraduate at Warwick University, and I studied theatre and performing arts there. And while doing that, there was a lot going on. I was sort of asking a lot of questions about myself and my identity. I was asking a lot of questions about my career. What did I want to do in the future? You know, who did I want to be 20 years down the line from uni? And for me, theatre, I love the theatre. I think, you know, it's been such a shame these last 2 years of lockdown and not having many arts facilities operational. And I the theatre for me is like, I grew up doing the theatre. I grew up acting, performing, singing. Like, it's such a big part of me. But I also came to recognise that there was more going on in my life, sort of involving the theatre, and I was very guilty of using the theatre as an escape mechanism for my life. Like, I think there was a lot of things that I wasn't addressing, like, you know, my identity, my mental health, and sort of myself as a person. And I would dive into the theatre to escape the reality of my own life, which you know, was quite sad. And I did that for many years. And, you know, I recognize that. I still love the theatre, but I realized it wasn't for me as a career. And actually, you know, I love it and I'll do it as a hobby, but it's not where I see myself. It was a very, you know, useful way of exploring and discovering my identity. And but I think I kind of recognized it for what it was, and just that it wasn't where I wanted to spend my time. And funnily enough, while doing my theatre degree, I had I needed money to, you know,
as students
to pay for our massive beer fund, so I started working as a first aider for the student union nightclub. It was fun. You know, in terms of medical things, it wasn't that serious. It was, you know, helping drunk teenagers off the toilet, you know, when they like collapsed a pool of their own vomit. Like,
oh, it's lovely.
I know, sorry, I won't.
I don't miss those
classy.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was kind of, I spent most of my, you know, my nights doing that, and I really, really enjoyed it. I think I really found like a real reward in helping people. And I, for someone who has been through an awful lot in their life, I really felt like I could, you know, I wanted to be there for people who were going through as bad a time as I had been. And so it kind of, that then led on after doing it sort of all throughout my undergrad. A medical friend of mine asked if I wanted to go and work at festivals, so I then went and sort of took it the next step and went and worked at a couple of festivals around the country, where I met some A&E nurses and doctors and some more medical team, and they all inspired me to go into the medical field. And so I went off to go and get my nursing degree.
Jeez, that's quite the difference, isn't it? Like I worked in theatre before COVID, doing like the physical therapy side, and I can definitely I can see a lot of people do go into it as kind of like an escape, and a lot of them, you can see it, it's their way of kind of getting away from whatever was going on, especially as like maybe a teenager. And that's just what they've kind of carried on as their career.
But that must get exhausting every single day.
It does. You know, and I think it's recognizing that, you know, it's a fabulous escape mechanism, you know, and it's really fun to do. And it's, you know, theatre is magical and wonderful, but you can't live on the stage.
No.
It doesn't, it's not healthy.
Because as well with you saying that, like, obviously it helped you find out who you are and, like, your identity, like theatre, that kind of helped form that. I can understand that as well, because I didn't come out until after I'd worked in theatre, because I felt like in that environment it was so much more like accepting and kind and everything like that, and you kind of felt like you weren't going to be judged, and it was a really nice kind of environment to go in. So I can see why people kind of get sucked into it, because, you know, you feel like you don't feel like the odd one out.
For sure. Nice. That's really true. It's really true.
And I think as well, you know, again, kind of completely relate, because I did the exact same thing. I went into advertising and creativity and then decided actually that my heart was fulfilled by helping people, hence why I'm a substance misuse practitioner now. So I can completely get that change. But I just think yours particularly is amazing, because, you know, like you say, to go from a place of completely feeling kind of stuck in a place that you weren't comfortable with and not kind of fully living your truth, as it were, I love that phrase, to then kind of dedicate your life to helping other people, I just think that's amazing. And I think as well, to try and do it in this last year, you know, it was your last year, right, of your nursing qualification, that you were in the middle of a pandemic. So yeah, that I imagine was a fair challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't ask for it. I didn't want it, but it happened. Qualifying in the middle of COVID has definitely brought its own challenges. Mm-hmm. It's been hard. It's been hard on all of us.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's in the NHS.
Yeah, no, definitely. My family are in the NHS as well, and I completely can understand that. But I just think that's what makes it even more amazing. amazing. Is, you know, so I suppose that leads me on to kind of our next question, was because, you know, how was it kind of training to be a nurse whilst also transitioning?
So by the time I came to do my nursing degree, I had been out for about a year, and I think I am very lucky in sort of, I don't like this phrase, but it's the only one that kind of fits, is that I'm very lucky in that after about a year, I started passing very well. And it became, even though I was still, you know, carrying on with my transition journey, it became much more of a background thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that I found really sort of, that I found with my transition, is that it's not a quick thing. It's a long time, no. You know, it's for the rest of your life. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, regardless of what you decide to do with your medical or, you know, social transitions, whoever you are as a trans individual, I think it's not something that changes overnight. It takes its time. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And I am aware of my own sort of privilege in the sense that I don't look trans. Like by the time I rocked up to my nursing degree, no one had any idea. Mm-hmm. I was sort of just another face in the crowd. And that is why almost I became more vocal about trans things, is because I want to be sort of a role model for mm-hmm. for younger, you know, I want to be the role model that I didn't have mm-hmm. for younger trans individuals. And, you know, that's why I had a public transition. I have a very public Instagram, mm-hmm. And sort of with my friends on Facebook can see I post updates and stuff. And because it's my way of sort of sharing and spreading awareness of trans identities, and the fact that, you know, trans identities exist and we have always existed. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of trans individuals, you don't necessarily know a trans, and, you know, a lot of people who, for them, trans identities are a sort of a theoretical concept. They've never, you know, they think they've never met one. They probably have, but they've just been going about their daily business, because at the end of the day, that's what we as trans individuals want to do, is just carry on with our lives. And I can't answer that question. It's that by the time I came to do my nursing, it was very much, the transition journey was very much sort of all well on its way, and I didn't necessarily encounter many obstacles in being trans in nursing. Being a trans individual in healthcare as a patient is a completely different topic, and we'll probably need a separate podcast episode, because that
season two
because that is another topic. But I'm not necessarily the best person to speak about that.
Okay, well, we completely respect that, and like I said, you know, at the end of the day, this is about you feeling comfortable in talking about your experience. And, you know, as we said at the beginning, this isn't something we're not saying this is like the world according to us three on this podcast. This is, you know, everybody, like you say, has their own lives and their own experiences. And, you know, like you said there, I think it's really interesting what you said, like, you know, some people, you know, who are trans, they actually don't want to constantly be identified as trans. They want to maybe just live their lives as that, you know, gender they identify as, and just carry on. And would probably be delighted that people wouldn't kind of, like, I know what you're saying about like the horrible word kind of passing, but, you know, might not want that. But actually the fact that, you know, for me on your social media, I mean, you've got this really iconic photo of you kind of wearing the trans flag, and I love it because it's, you know, it's saying actually we are here. And like you say, that wasn't something we saw in person or on social media or really at all, you know, growing up. And that is really inspirational. And the fact that, and I've said this to you before, the fact that you are so open about kind of visually what you look like prior to transitioning, and kind of not hating that previous identity, kind of acknowledging that it existed, but also saying I'm still me inside, you know.
I'm actually glad you mentioned that, because that's it's a very interesting topic for me, because I know trans individuals, you know, I have friends who completely try to delete or shut out their previous life before transition. Mm-hmm. And I kind of very early on, from my very sort of the beginning of my transition, I knew that wasn't going to be possible for me. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, I've had Facebook since I was 13. Like, I couldn't even begin to like go and like to do a vast edit of my entire life on Facebook would take me months, if not a year, like to do. And I think in this world of technology that we live on, that we live in, slip of the tongue there, there is, you know, we're very, our lives are very public and are very open. And I think for me, I accepted very early on that I would need to sort of be comfortable with sort of my like images and and you know, entry diary, you know, status updates and entries and, you know, anything of me prior to transition. And by sort of when I post those images in sort of alongside each other, it's part of me claiming you know, a bit, you know, being open and claiming my own identity and both before and after transition, because otherwise I wouldn't want to, like, if I hid it, there's always the potential that someone would try and get it to then shame me or, you know, create a negative narrative about me. And I think by posting those images of me prior to my transition, I could be like, yeah, I look like that. And, you know, that's just me. It's part of, it's my life. That's what I look like before I transitioned. It's like, either way, I see it as just like a bad teenage goth phase, you know?
Yeah. Like, and we all went through something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Like we all went through phases where we wore, like, you know, you look back on your, you know,
dodgy haircuts.
Yeah, secondary school, you're like, why did I wear that? And I think for me, that's kind of how I view my old identity, is that, you know, I do mourn for, you know, a little part of me that is not, you know, there anymore, but I celebrate who I am now and who I am today,
which is beautiful and amazing. And I love that you're prepared to come on and talk about that, because it is, you're right, it's really potentially something that people might worry about. You know, people who maybe don't identify as trans or as kind of cisgender might look at that and think, oh, you know, should I kind of delete photos of me being friends with this person prior to, you know, that kind of anxiety around it. But actually, like you say, it's acknowledging that inside they're still the same person. That's still your friend. That's still someone you've loved and cared about for years. So for you to take that ownership and take that pride and courage will inspire others around you to be able to do the same. And you know, I think that's lovely.
I also think as well that the way that you explained it was really good. And I think it's a way that a lot of people can maybe relate to it, in the sense of, again, like, people went through a goth phase, and it doesn't mean that that's who they are now, but that's who they were at school. And if they've got all, like, I know I've got photos on Facebook from when I was like 14 that I would rather never have existed. But I think it's a really good way to explain it to people who maybe don't understand, and just like they can then relate to that, because, you know, everyone's had something like that in the past, not to the same scale, but it's just, yeah, it will help people, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, it is, you know, we all have photos that we'd rather weren't online, or, you know, looking back in sort of the old internet diary, like, so much of our lives is public knowledge, especially if, you know, if our generation growing up with the internet and with social media before, like, all, like, the filters kicked in. Yeah, so there's just so much out there that I was kind of like, I think I've just got to go for it and just got to, like, have it public, but, you know, acknowledge it as, yeah, like, I think people do get, like, whenever I encounter friends and family that I knew prior to, you know, I know prior to my transition, there was definitely in the initial stages this nervousness about getting it wrong, about saying the wrong pronouns, about offending me. And I think for me, I've always been super, super chill, because I know I'd rather people muck up to me and then muck up to someone they meet on the street who takes it the wrong way. And, you know, and then they get into a sticky situation. So I've always said to my family and friends, like, it's cool. Like, don't worry about it. Like, just
have a conversation. Let's talk about it. You know, that, yeah, completely. I think that's something we need to do as a society. As a society, better in general, isn't it? Have conversations. I get what you're saying. You know, have a conversation with somebody you trust and can ask those questions. And I think that's why, again, bringing it back to kind of social media, you having that visual presence. If somebody doesn't have a friend they can ask, or a family member, you know, knowing that there's people online who are happy to talk about gender and the construct of identity and sexuality and, you know, all of that individual kind of personal things. If you don't have those places to go, like, let's make that a conversation.
For sure.
How do you find that with, like, obviously online, you're probably going to get a mixture of comments from people. Some, hopefully majority of them are very positive, because they should be, but there's always bound to be, I guess, a few negative things thrown in there. So how do you handle those negative comments, like whether that be online or maybe in person, or how do you deal with that?
So I make a rule of thumb never to read the comments section of any trans related article, just for my own mental health. In terms of, like, more directly aimed at me, like, I've had, so I haven't necessarily had that negative, like, offensive messages targeted at me. I have had quite a lot of, I get, like, messages and stuff from sort of people on the internet who are sort of curious and asking about my experience, and quite often they'll misgender me, or, and then, you know, then I'll explain to them, no, that's the wrong pronouns, like, this is what you use for a trans woman, and then they still do it, and then I block them. And, like, I always try and educate rather than put down. There are some people out there that I just have to block straight away, that message me unsolicited things, that I just block and delete them. And but then I think that is something that's more getting into territory that's faced by any sort of female online, that is, that, you know, that comes in, that's sort of veering more into sort of sexism than sort of transphobia. The most sort of, I think, I guess you could say, not offensive, but, well, discrimination I get online is dating. Now, dating as a trans individual is complex. Like, it's a difficult road, because there's a lot of people out there with opinions on who their partners should be or should or shouldn't look like. And the sort of, I have had a lot of people of both genders sort of block me or delete me or ghost me once they discover I'm trans, which is, I think, something a lot of trans individuals can relate to.
Mm-hmm. I think it's obviously hard hitting whenever we hear kind of topics like this. And, like I say, you know, prior to this podcast, I was doing a lot of research around kind of particular topics that people struggle with. And I think, you know, like you say, for yourself, who's got kind of a maybe more vocal social media presence, that, you know, when you say the word discover, is that you kind of telling people, you know, kind of that you're trans, or is that more, do you think people seeing social media, or?
So I've kind of had a play. Online dating fascinates me. I think it's a really weird thing. like, I don't generally tend to date people I talk to online. I tend to sort of call me old fashioned, but I tend to go on dates with people who know me. And I, you know, that I meet in real life. But I have had online dating profiles, and I have kind of on many different sites. And sometimes I put that I'm trans, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'll have an account where I say I'm trans, then I'll delete it and create another one where I say I'm not. And just to see kind of the reactions of people and how sort of how people react. And so sort of in terms of discover, like, yeah, it could be through a number of us, because could be because I tell them straight away, I have it on my profile, mm-hmm. or I don't have it on my profile and I tell them once they've messaged me, mm-hmm. because, you know, I thought, well, actually I'd like people to, you know, like me before I, you know, before I talk to them and they get to
reveal
know me.
Something
and,
really quite personal.
Yeah, exactly. And actually that was very interesting, because then once you've got them in a conversation, you can actually see how they react rather than sort of the initial sort of scrolling where people are like, oh no, she's trans, I don't date trans girls, and you know, that narrative there, which is just
I was just saying, could it potentially, some people on dating websites, when they don't yet know you like person to person, would they maybe be slightly concerned about saying the wrong thing, so therefore they just avoid conversation altogether? I know obviously that won't be some people, but do you reckon some people might just be a little bit nervous and not want to offend? And
I'd like to believe that. I'd like to think that it would be it's a nervous thing, but I do think there is this counts for not just dating but for sort of social media in general. There's a certain sort of false confidence that being on social media sort of, or on a dating app can give people, with they think that they can behave in a manner that is that they wouldn't face to face. So sort of offensive, virtual, or totally just, you know, the whole swipe right, swipe left thing. It's just, you know, you can literally delete someone out of your life and never talk to them again. And that, I think, like, and it's the same, yeah, with Facebook, with social media, you can be talking to someone. And I do think that it gives, sometimes people do stuff that they, or, you know, or say stuff that they wouldn't never say face to face, because the illusion of sort of they've got a screen in between you and them, and they're not in the same room, you know, and so they feel that they can just go woof and boom, you're out of, you know, it's an inconvenience and suddenly you're out of their life and forgotten.
I think as well with social media, I mean, we've talked a lot about social media today, which is really interesting, but I think as well, you know, the thing about social media, especially with the whole swipe left, swipe right thing, it's so visual, it's so based on how someone visually presents. And I think particularly, you know, something I'm really passionate about is that obviously kind of gender and identity, you know, it's massively fluid, and a lot of people kind of, you know, masculinity, femininity, being androgynous, like, it's the thing about social media dating is it's all so visual, it's based on what you look like. And so for somebody that maybe doesn't kind of perfectly fit into a box or a category of femininity or masculinity or, you know, anything else, you're immediately putting yourself out there to be judged based on how you present. And, you know, I'm a very feminine girl, I always have been. I might not have the most ladylike mouth at all at times, but I'm very feminine, so I don't have to kind of worry about that. But I can understand why somebody, if they, you know, don't feel they fit into that one box and they do feel more fluid in the way that they like visually present, that, you know, there would be anxiety there. But at the same time, I think, like Liv says, you know, actually there's so much transphobia in the UK, and it's those, you know, like, it's not always that aggressive. It might literally be that somebody kind of innately will not, you know, accept somebody if they think that they look too masculine for them, or, you know, think, oh, I don't want that person my own because they look manly. And that, I think that's the problem with, like you say, dating on, well, one of the problems of dating on social media, especially I imagine if you're trans, is that you have to choose what you're going to present to people. And the sad likelihood is that quite often people aren't gonna, you know, are gonna discriminate.
I mean, I can
not even
relate,
think that they're discriminating.
No, like, I can relate to that in the sense of when I used to date guys, obviously I don't dress the most girly at all. Like, I don't wear pink, I don't really wear dresses, you know. I've got, how many plaid shirts have I got in my wardrobe? Let's we can count them. So I think that was a similar thing, is I never really used to get many matches at all if I ever went on a dating site, because I feel like I wasn't the mini dress, long flowy hair, kind of that kind of look. And yeah, so I noticed that.
Yeah, and I think it's actually something that is like for our generation very noticing, because we grew up in the noughties with like rampant sexist pop. Mm-hmm. Like if you look back at noughties culture, like there's some lots of fun there, but there's also like we grew up with like Britney and, you know, sort of and
Girls Are Out.
And role models that necessarily, you know, were like not presenting the best picture of femininity and what femininity should be. And I think definitely when you're in sort of a social situation like school, you know, there is very much a girls must do this and boys must do this. And I'd like to think it's not, you know, that we're learning as a cult, as a society, and that it's not so much now, but definitely for us growing up, we still had a lot, it sort of still hadn't found its way. Trans healthcare is not great in this country, and we have a long, long way to go. And I think what you were saying earlier about sort of one thing that really struck me was when you were talking about your trans friends who can't see the future. And I think that for me is why I am publicly trans. And I remember what it was like to not see yourself having a future. And for me, like, I am public in my identity and sort of, you know, on social media and sort of less so at work, but, you know, I'm still me at work and, you know, just being me, myself. And I think just by doing that, I want to sort of show anyone who, you know, because I could encounter, you know, someone who is trans, but they're not out, you know, I could encounter, I just have no idea. And I think I just want to, like, by just being me, I just want to present that there is a future for trans identities and people, you know, who are trans or questioning or not yet. And I think it's really important to see yourself having a future, because if you don't, then you can go to some really horrible places in your mind. And yeah, I think that's one of the most important things for me is, you know, it's hard, you know, and oh my God, it was a nightmare at the beginning. Like coming out, I was like, what have I done? Oh my God. And, you know, it's not an easy road, especially the first few months of sort of coming out and transitioning, you know, but to honest, accepting yourself and coming out and living your truth, as you like to say, is the hard bit. And, you know, I think for me, it's by being me, I just want to show other trans individuals that there is, you know, there is a future for everyone, no matter, you know, what identity or, you know, where, whatever your background, wherever you've come from, we all, you know, there is a future, you know, for the LGBT community.
How did you go about getting your GRC and how did you find that process? Again, that could be a whole other podcast, I'm sure.
GRC, so the gender recognition certificate, for anyone who didn't know what that is. The GRC is something that I know it's a hot topic. It's on a lot of people's minds, and especially with the whole previous year where our lovely equalities minister has made it very difficult to access and has stopped the process from being made easier. So I, with my transition, I have the luck and sort of the privilege of being able to privately fund my transition, which meant that I was seen by services a lot quicker than I would have been on the NHS. And I was able to sort of start the ball rolling with my whole medical transition, sort of around about the same time as coming out and having a social transition. And sort of the GRC has sort of two pathways that you can take. One of which is you live as a, you know, out and about trans individual for 2 years, and then you have to get signed off by lots of different doctors and provide evidence, which is what I did. So it was sort of, I made sure to keep a record of like every time, like when I changed my bank details, when I changed my passport, when I changed my driver's license, when I changed like any kind of official thing, I kept the paperwork and things like that, and you know, liaised with my doctors to get the right reports and the right statements in, and sort of I sent that as a huge pack sort of about 2.5 years after coming out to the GRC, and it took them a while, but they processed it eventually, and I was lucky enough to have been awarded GRC. And like, it's not something that all trans individuals want to get. You know, it is a very long-winded, and you know, like I said, you have to provide evidence, which for some people they feel such quite offended by.
Concept, yeah, I can understand why.
It's such a strange concept to just to say, you know, that I am. This is a piece of paper that proves who I am, and I am who I say I am. Then, rather discriminatorily, sort of discriminatorily, the other pathway that you can choose to apply for GRC is if you have surgery, like gender reassignment surgery, which is not something that all trans individuals choose to do, and it's not one that's readily available that quickly in the early period of your transition. So either way, it does always end up being roughly around 2 years before you can sort of get access to sort of your legal status as you know, protection in the UK, which is you know, it's 2 years is a long time.
Yeah,
like
definitely.
You know, and anything can happen, and it is sad that it takes so long, and
it's crazy as well.
So many,
could spend 2 years trying to get to that place, and then I imagine there's lots of times where maybe they don't have enough, like viewers, I'm doing air quotes, listeners, even not viewers, listeners, you know, evidence. They could not have enough evidence, or the evidence could not be what that, you know, that's crazy that someone could have to kind of commit to, like you say, remembering all that paperwork and everything like that, you know, for 2 years, and then might even then still, you know, be told actually we haven't got enough evidence, which I can understand why people feel so emotional about. I mean, what you've said there as well about, you know, not every trans individual actually wants to have gender reassignment surgery, or, you know, wants to kind of represent maybe what people think of trans in their mind. I mean, I found that really interesting when I kind of discovered that that's not necessarily what everybody wants, and it's actually more about, you know, body dysmorphia and gender dysmorphia, and it's about the harm that somebody may feel if that they kind of, you know, some people are quite happy to live physically as a different gender, kind of in terms of not gender, sorry, sex, in terms of their body, and still be quite content in their identity, but other people might need that surgery to feel completely at peace within themselves. And I found that really interesting, because I wasn't fully aware of kind of maybe the scale that people, you know, have, that, you know, obviously not everyone's the same, but I think we have a kind of
and
mass.
I do think that yeah, I do think that the, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I do think that is white part, like part of the whole sort of part and parcel of the whole trans community, and why there's so many conflicting narratives is because we are all different. Like, whereas if you're gay, you like the same, you know, you know, if you're gay, you're gay. Like, you, there's not really much like difference in terms of narrative there. Like, you know, you have different tastes on, you know, who you're attracted to. But in terms of, it's kind of, it's a lot simpler as an identity. And like, that is by no means me trying to put down or sort of just, you know, offend the gay community there. I'm just saying, it's like with trans, there's a lot more scale and a lot, many, many different more, like transgender is an umbrella term in itself. There are many, many more identities beneath that. Mm-hmm. And many, everyone has different ways of sort of being themselves and what they like to be called and the terminology that they use, which is why it's such a minefield and why it's very easy for someone who's not part of the community to get really confused quite quickly or not understand it and then offend someone, because everyone has different ways. Mm-hmm. Every trans individual uses various variations of different terminology and ways of viewing themselves, like as transgender. I know people who don't even like the word transgender. Sorry, Holly, I know I would just try to say
it's all right, that's part and parcel of being on the podcast. No, I was just going to say that actually, no, I find that really interesting as well. I was reading, because I follow a lot of positive pro support and pro LGBTQ plus community Instagram accounts and stuff. And I read something the other day that was really interesting about kind of how people like to refer to their identity prior to transition. And some people don't like kind of, you know, sometimes people don't like referring to, you know, when I was male or prior to my transition when I was male, or, you know, that sort of thing, because they feel that, you know, they were always that identity inside. And then other people kind of are quite happy to say, actually, I would refer to myself previously as, you know, when I identified as male, but some people don't like that. And I think you're right, it can be a minefield if somebody doesn't understand, but that's where the beauty of what you were saying before about actually just asking somebody, you know, if it's somebody you love and somebody you know and they've come out, ask them what it is that they would like, and that might change as well. They might 2 years into their transition completely change their mind on that, and that's okay. You know, the transparency is key here. It's about not being afraid to ask and knowing that it's coming from a place of love, I would hope.
Totally agree.
Okay. Right, okay, so we're going to get on to my favourite part of our podcast, even though this has been like a lovely, lovely conversation today, which is going to be our BuzzFeed quiz. Are you excited, Liv? You look really excited.
I am so excited. I cannot wait.
It's the highlight of your weekend. Okay. So I just thought, since Mermaids is such an amazing trans charity in the UK, that I would do the quiz, what type of mermaid are you? Just for a bit of fun.
Aww.
I didn't know that there was more than one type of mermaid though, so I have done this quiz on myself first so that I knew what the types of mermaids were. So shall we get into the quiz?
Let's go.
Okay. So the first question is, what element speaks to you? Fire, water, earth, air, or spirit? I don't know if spirit is an element, but it's on there.
Water. I've always been a fan of the sea.
Me too. Okay, what color is your mermaid hair? Is it blonde, brown or black, which is one answer, red, white or silver, blue or green?
It's gotta be red. I've always
there's little mermaid vibes hair. Aerial vibes. Living for it.
Yes.
Okay. What is your tail colour? Blue, purple, red, pink, green, or pearl?
What was the choices again? Sorry.
Blue, purple, red, pink, green, or pearl?
Oh, I thought you said purple twice. I got really confused. I realised you said pearl.
Pearl, like the shell. This is a hard one for you. You are debating.
Purple.
Okay. This is a strange question considering we're in lockdown. When was the last time you visited the ocean? Was it today? Was it yesterday? Was it a week ago? A month ago? A few months ago? Or a year ago? You've just moved to Brighton though, so this might be more recent.
It was today because I went and sat by the sea this morning.
I'm so jealous. I can't even contain my jealousy. Okay, you must be quite close by to it then.
Yeah.
Must be nice. Oh, cry. I can't wait for Brighton Pride if they actually have it this year. Okay.
It's meant to be going ahead.
Oh, exciting. Okay, and lastly, pick a stone or crystal. There is ruby, quartz, citrine, emerald, sapphire, or I can't say this one, malachite. I don't know what that is.
Sapphire.
Okay.
Is it going to be? Drum roll.
Well, I feel like they just picked your last answer and chose that as what you are. You are a sapphire mermaid. And it says, as a sapphire mermaid, your heart belongs to the deep, dark depths of the ocean. You're a loner by nature, but every now and then someone will come. I shouldn't have stopped there. Someone will come along that will make an exception for. Sapphire mermaids are drawn to colder climates, which is why you thrive in the winter.
I mean, not that we're taking too much into this, but that is a pretty good description of me. So there you go.
And that's why sapphire mermaid.
And there's a little, I'll just show you the picture, even though the listeners can't see the picture. It's like...
Yeah, there we go.
That was nice. When I did it, I was an air mermaid, which again, I don't know what the hell an air mermaid is. Like, what do they do? Not live in the water. So mine wasn't very accurate. But you've got a mermaid tattoo that you're trying to show me.
It was very.
You can see the tail, but lovely.
I know you can see the tail. It was really funny you said that because I do. I have a for the listeners, I have a tattoo of a mermaid on my upper left arm.
I didn't even know that, so just...
Well, now you can add a sapphire to it. Just
colour it in blue.
Oh, do you know what? Actually, I should just get another one and just have a sapphire mermaid on my lower arm.
And then podcast, like, queer it a podcast. As dedication.
How about no?
I'll get back to you on that one.
Okay, cool. Right, well, thank you so much for coming on to our podcast.
Thank you.
It's lovely to meet you.
Yes, you too. We hope you enjoyed the ramblings of two mid-20s queers in lockdown.
Maybe it had you smiling while you were on the bus.
Or while you brush your dog.
Or even while you rearrange your fridge for the 52nd time this lockdown.
This was episode one.
If you have any questions, comments, stories, good queer jokes, because AJs are awful.
Oi. Or topics you'd like us to cover in the future episodes, then you can contact us on Instagram at @querio_pod, or you can email querio.podcast@gmail.com.
Querio!
Querio! Querio. That was so bad we did that.